This morning, America's first news starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Morning, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Boeing gets grounded. Good morning, I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. It is Monday, March 11th. Glad you're with us. Here's what we have for you this hour.
The second deadly crash of a Boeing 737 MAX, this time in Ethiopia, with 157 people on board, has led a couple of countries to suspend use of that aircraft.
President Trump is seeking $8.6 billion for a border wall in the budget proposal that the White House will release today.
A woman who crossed a barrier at a zoo in Arizona to get a selfie with a jaguar suffered serious injuries to her arm when the animal swiped at her.
And the cities where it will cost you more than $100,000 per year to retire.
$51,000 projected annual spending for people over 65. This is an average again, you know, so it might skew a little high, but that is a ton. San Jose, California comes in at number two for $129,000. And then it's New York, Seattle, and Honolulu.
Katie Hill at MarketWatch on where it costs a bundle to retire, her list in about 20 minutes. Aviation investigators are trying to figure out why an Ethiopian Airlines jet crashed minutes after departing, killing all 157 on board, including eight Americans. The plane had just departed the city of Addis Ababa yesterday and was en route to Nairobi, Kenya, when the jetliner's pilot reported an unspecified problem and asked to return to the airport. 6 minutes after departure, the plane plunged to the ground. James Macharia is transportation secretary in Kenya.
There were at least 35 nationalities. And I'm saying at least because as of now, two are unknown.
It's the second accident involving Boeing's new 737 MAX model in recent months. 189 people were killed in October on the same model operated by Lion Air in Indonesia. In response, China has now ordered the temporary grounding of all 737 MAX aircraft. Ethiopian Airlines has done the same. A number of people on board Flight 302 to Nairobi were heading to a global UN Environment Program summit. The White House will release its budget proposal today. In it will be President Trump's request for $8.6 billion for additional barriers along the southern U.S. border. The Wall Street Journal says the document will propose $2.7 trillion in cuts as well to non-defense discretionary spending over the next decade, in part by reducing spending by 5% next year below current federal spending caps. The budget also proposes increases on certain military matters and on veterans' health care. It will not have the support of Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer.
The same thing will repeat itself if he tries this again, so we hope he's learned his lesson.
National Economic Advisor Larry Kudlow was asked on Fox News Sunday if there could be another funding battle that leads to another government shutdown.
I suppose there will be. I would just say that the whole issue of the wall and border security is of paramount importance. We have a crisis down there.
Congress is unlikely to approve anything that closely resembles the White House budget as Democrats control the House. The proposal is essentially an opening bid in negotiations. Well, President Trump is entering a tumultuous stretch in his roller coaster relationship with Congress, setting up some of his biggest battles to date. Jordan Carney, Senate reporter at The Hill, has a preview. Jordan, what's ahead?
The Senate is going to be taking up two bills that will force the president to use his first two vetoes. The first bill, I think everyone's probably well aware of right now, is the resolution of disapproval on the emergency declaration. The Senate's supposed to vote on that in some form. There's a second bill supporters are wanting to bring back up, a resolution that would end U.S. support for Saudi military campaign in Yemen. It passed the Senate in December, but you know, we kind of hit the end of the 115th Congress, so they are having to pass it again. The White House has said it's going to veto that. supporters are wanting to try to bring it up, but it's got some procedural hurdles that might push it back toward, closer to the kind of the end of the month.
So what does this mean politically?
it's obviously one of the, I guess I would say, the more hairy stretches of this administration's relationship with Congress. It's going to be, you know, the first time that the president has had to veto legislation. And I mean, I think it's worth noting that this is a Republican controlled Senate. So the only way these bills can get to the president's desk and force him to use these vetoes is if Democrats can win over a handful of Republican senators.
Also, you said the president has gone on offense, meaning what? What's he done?
So the president, as I think we all have discovered, likes to tweet things and sort of warn Republican senators. He's been tweeting, warning Republican senators that, you know, this would be very dangerous for them to vote specifically against his emergency declaration. He had a conversation with Lindsey Graham where Graham said that the president sort of conveyed that he thought Republican senators were playing with fire, because they were going to be voting against the emergency declaration. This comes as you've got sort of on the other side of the Capitol, you've got the probes from House Democrats really heating up and sort of causing more headaches from Capitol Hill for this president. And Graham and the president talked a little bit about that, and he mentioned that, you know, the president felt like Democrats were trying to take a wrecking ball to his life, and he was really confused about why Congress wasn't trying to be more bipartisan, and specifically brought up that he was surprised they hadn't done anything on infrastructure. So just kind of an interesting dichotomy between what's actually happening on Capitol Hill and what the president is telling senators he would like to be happening on Capitol Hill.
Right. We're speaking with Jordan Carney, Senate reporter at The Hill. She's written a piece entitled "Trump Set for Tumultuous Ride with Congress." Go back to the measure regarding the Saudi military and this measure to end U.S. support. What's that? Where did that come from? Is that from the Khashoggi murder?
So this actually predates Khashoggi a little. They brought it up late last year, and it was sort of mixed with Khashoggi because it was happening, you know, while the administration was briefing Congress on that. But the group that is sort of behind this measure in the Senate, it's Chris Murphy, Mike Lee, and Bernie Sanders, so sort of an odd political mix there. And they've sort of been concerned about particularly civilian casualties within the Yemen civil war for a while. They passed a resolution, or they passed basically the same exact resolution in December with, you know, a handful of Republican senators, and it was pretty notable at the time because they've been trying to pass this resolution for a while, and they've always fallen a little short. The House passed a resolution sort of along similar lines this year, but because of some procedural hurdles in the Senate, it's not going to be able to be taken up in the Senate. They're going to have to pass a different resolution in the Senate, and it's going to have to go back to the House before it can go to Trump's desk, where he's going to probably veto it.
And in the midst of all this, as you point out, the Trump administration introduces his latest budget.
I mean, even when you talk to Republican senators about that, they sort of acknowledge, you know, I mean, I talked to Richard Shelley, who's the Senate Appropriations Chairman and sticks pretty closely by the president, but even he was sort of acknowledging, you know, this is a proposal from the administration, not, you know, it's not really ever expected that it's going to get enacted by Congress wholesale. Congress tends to have their own ideas on government funding.
Thanks, Jordan. Jordan Carney, Senate reporter at The Hill. 14 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Thanks for joining us. Welcome into Monday. Venezuelans are getting desperate after a nationwide blackout reached a fourth day yesterday. Homes are suffering from a lack of drinking water, and there's minimal cell phone reception. More from This Morning's Mike Gavin.
Authorities have managed to provide only patchy access to power since the outage began on Thursday. President Nicolas Maduro blames sabotage by the U.S., but critics point to incompetence and corruption. The government yesterday suspended school and business activities. Lines at gas stations extended for blocks. Families waited to buy potable water. Merchants, unable to keep refrigerators working, began giving away cheese, vegetables, and meat. Reuters says one supermarket in the capital of Caracas was looted last evening, triggering a shootout with police. Gordon.
Thank you, Mike. Reuters says the country's worst ever power outage comes as President Maduro faces a hyperinflationary economic collapse and an unprecedented political crisis. Opposition leader Juan Guaido in January invoked the Constitution to assume the presidency after declaring Mr. Maduro's 2018 re-election
a fraud. It's 21 minutes after the hour on this morning. Jennifer Koshenka is here with more of America's First News.
Gordon, Ethiopian Airlines has grounded all of its Boeing 737 MAX 8 aircraft as an extra safety precaution following the crash of one of its planes, in which 157 people were killed as Ethiopia marks a day of mourning. Although it isn't known yet what caused the crash of the new plane in clear weather outside Addis Ababa yesterday, the airline decided to ground its remaining four 737 MAX 8s until further notice. James Macharia is Kenya's Secretary of Transport and Infrastructure.
We had the highest number of casualties. The aircraft was destined for Nairobi. We should also be participating in the investigations.
Citizens of at least 35 countries died, including eight Americans. President Trump is reviving his border wall fight, preparing a new budget that will seek $8.6 billion for his signature project, impose steep spending cuts to other domestic programs, and set the stage for another fiscal battle. National Economic Advisor Larry Kudlow told Fox the White House is prepared for another fight over a wall.
I suppose there will be. I would just say that the whole issue of the wall and border security is of paramount importance. We have a crisis down there.
Fresh off the longest government shutdown in history, Trump's 2020 proposal shows he is eager to confront Congress again to boost defense spending and cut $2.7 trillion in non-defense spending over a decade. A jaguar attacked a woman who crossed a barrier to take a photo with the animal at an Arizona zoo Saturday evening. The woman sustained arm injuries in the attack at the Wildlife World Zoo in Litchfield Park. Paramedics were called at the request of the woman's family, and at no point was the jaguar out of its enclosure. The zoo says the jaguar will not be put down, but it is considering adding additional barriers to prevent further incidents.
This war is just the beginning.
I'm not going to fight your war. I'm going to end it.
Captain Marvel has become one of the biggest blockbusters ever, led by a woman. The movie starring Brie Larson took in $153 million in its first weekend in North American theaters, while the global total soared past $455 million. That makes it one of Marvel's most successful character debuts.
Impressive. My son saw it Saturday night. Like, he liked it. He likes the tie-in to like all the other characters and stuff.
Yeah, I don't get that stuff. Don't ask me about it.
I don't get it either. 23 minutes after the hour. Retirement doesn't come cheap. The average over 65 household spends just over $49,000 a year on average. Housing eats up the largest share of that, though. Healthcare, transportation, and food obviously also factor heavily. And in some cities like San Francisco or San Jose, the cost is staggering. More from Katie Hill, editor at MarketWatch. Katie, give us some findings.
These are people who are still paying a mortgage. I mean, hopefully you've paid off your mortgage by the time you hit 65. A lot of people haven't, but or they're still paying rent or whatever. But in San Francisco, $151,000 projected annual spending for people over 65. This is an average, again, you know, so it might skew a little high, but that is a ton. San Jose, California comes in at number two for $129,000. And then it's New York, Seattle, and Honolulu. Each of them is about $100,000 roughly. So a lot of money.
You know, that makes sense as to why you never really hear people say, "Well, I can't wait to retire to San Francisco," right? Or I so look forward to my golden years in New York, or who else made the list? L.A., Washington. Like, you know, these cities never come up.
No. You know, it's interesting to me because Oakland ended up on the list, too. It was just like the Bay Area just slammed on this list, right? Oakland, San Jose, San Francisco are the most expensive cities for people over 65. All three of them shook out. And then Long Beach, California, Los Angeles, California. I mean, California is really, really dominating up there. People think, oh, the weather, I love it, I want to go there. Nope, you shouldn't. Expensive.
We're speaking with Katie Hill, editor at MarketWatch. Her piece is called "The Cities in Which It Costs $100,000 a Year or More to Retire." So what else jumped out here? I almost feel like, you know, it should read, "Here are places not to go in retirement," unless you are obviously ultra wealthy.
Right. And unless, by the way, right, if you've lived in San Francisco your whole life, you got your mortgage paid off, like all that stuff. I mean, that's a big difference here, right? But this includes housing costs. And so if you're, you know, if you got this big fat mortgage still going on and you want to live, you know, right in the middle of San Francisco, well, it's going to cost you probably.
All right. So you did take a look at some of the more affordable cities in which to retire.
Yes. So there's two cities you can retire to for under $40,000 a year, Cleveland and Toledo. And then Buffalo, New York, Fort Wayne, Indiana, and Memphis, Tennessee, also very affordable, hovering around $40,000. So that's well below the average amount spent for the over 65 set.
All right. So, and what are those folks roughly paying?
So though, Buffalo, Fort Wayne, and Memphis are about $40,000 a year, and on average, people over 65 are spending about $49,000 a year.
Yeah, we need a more of a happy medium.
Yeah,
right?
And again, you know, averages, right? Like, can skew higher with some, you know, but just it's still a lot. It's still a lot.
Katie Hill, editor at MarketWatch, based in New York. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Day one for a new employee. Instead of joining in productively, they face a confusing, disjointed process and piles of paper forms. With Kronos, you can automate the entire onboarding process, creating a better experience for employees and freeing you to focus on the human part of your job. HR, payroll, talent, and timekeeping in one unified system, all with a proven implementation approach and simplified, transparent pricing. Learn more at kronos.com/onboarding. Kronos. Workforce innovation that works.
I used to have a sweet tooth. Had it removed when I was a kid. So what do I crave instead of chocolate? A big red box from Grainger. Grainger satisfies my craving for great customer service with 24/7 support, effortless ordering, and same-day pickup or next-day delivery options. No busy signals, no cavities. I love Grainger. You know why? Because when it comes to reliable product and technical support, Grainger's got your back. Call or click Grainger.com to see for yourself. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
America's First News is online all the time. Follow us on Twitter at This Morning Show. Like us on Facebook or send us an email. This Morning at CompassMediaNetworks.com.
Thanks for spending time with us. Welcome into Monday, March 11. Gordon Deal, Jennifer Kashenka, some of our top stories and headlines. An Ethiopian Airlines jet has crashed, killing all 157 on board. President Trump's budget proposal today will ask for $8.6 billion in border wall funding. NASA wants $500 million more for moon projects. U.S. preparing for 180,000 migrants to cross the border by May. Tesla reversing a plan to close stores and instead will raise prices on its cars. Antonio Brown is now a Raider. And the Michigan man who received a congratulatory telegram 50 years late. That story in about 20 minutes. Massachusetts Senator and Democratic presidential contender Elizabeth Warren is proposing a tax of 2% on net worth above $50 million and 3% above $1 billion. It may never be enacted, yet Wall Street Journal chief economics commentator Greg Ipp says in spirit it marks a historic pivot in the focus of capital taxation from growth to inequality. Greg, explain.
There's been a lot of interest in inequality. Incomes have become more dispersed, with the rich doing much better than the middle class and the poor. And wealth, which is essentially all the income you've accumulated over your lifetime, becoming even more spread out. And so some of the more left of center candidates running for president for the Democratic Party are looking at maybe taxing wealth. So Elizabeth Warren has proposed that there be a tax on wealth above $50 million of 2%, and above $1 billion, it would be 3%. But I think that this raises some interesting questions, one of which is that would this actually be done at an acceptable cost in terms of economic growth? And I think there are some real questions about whether taxing wealth would end up discouraging investment and saving and therefore economic growth.
Wow. All right. So what could happen in theory?
Well, if you think about it, suppose you invest in a company that gives you an 8% return, or you expect an 8% return. That 8% is essentially going to become wealth. If there's a 3% tax on your total wealth, and that's basically you take away 3% of that 8%, that's like a 37.5% income tax. And this would come just a couple of years after the U.S. has just cut the corporate income tax rate. And that whole move is motivated by the view that if you tax companies and capital less, you'll get more investment and growth. So bringing in a wealth tax would serve to undo what the tax system in the U.S. and many other countries has been doing for the last 20 or 30 years.
Can't you argue that, I guess in some cases, that's double taxation?
In some cases, it would be double taxation. So, for example, if you're taxing corporate shares, shares of companies that have already paid corporate tax, there would be double taxation. Now, there's an interesting question here. It is the case that we do expect to tax people on capital gains if they invest in stocks or property, yeah. and it rises a lot over their lifetime. When they sell it, they pay a capital gains tax. But we also know a very large share of these capital gains never are taxed, because essentially they are bequeathed to the heirs of the person who owned the shares, and they can be passed down from generation to generation, growing in value and never be taxed. So one of the alternatives to a wealth taxation might be that when a person dies, you look at the current value of the of their stocks and their property and so on, and tax the capital gain then, even if they don't sell it. That would actually end up raising a lot of money. And one of the appeals of this process is that, number one, in some sense it closes a loophole in the existing tax system, and number two, it doesn't discourage investment and capital accumulation, because most people are probably not thinking about what happens to their estates when they die, when they're thinking of making an investment.
We're speaking with Greg Ipp, chief economics commentator at the Wall Street Journal. He's written a piece entitled "The Trouble with Taxing Wealth." All right, so this is something that Senator Elizabeth Warren is looking at?
That's correct. It has not been picked up a lot by any of the other Democratic candidates, but I think that we'll hear more about this, just because the whole issue of inequality, it's been very important to Democrats for many years, and it's probably become even more important in the last few years. You're even hearing radical ideas like there shouldn't be any billionaires. I haven't seen much support for that idea, but I think in the next year or two, as the nomination race picks up, there's going to be a lot more ferment and a lot more debating about various ideas about what, if anything, to do about inequality.
There's an interesting distinction, I guess, when talking about taxes here, between income and wealth.
That's right. So the income tax side is a whole other story altogether. And so, for example, we've had proposals from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and others that the top rate on income should be raised from the 30s to 70%.
Yeah.
Now, this too would have some disincentive effects for high earners, perhaps, or investors, but it wouldn't be as big a disincentive to investment as a wealth tax. The reason being that if you have a bad year, for example, and you don't earn anything, you don't pay the tax. The wealth tax hits you whether or not you have a good year, whether you actually earn anything that year. So not only does it discourage investing for income and working for income, it also discourages saving and accumulating a nest egg. Now, the vast majority of families would not be subject to the wealth tax that Senator Warren has proposed. But the principle is the same. If you're taxing wealth, you're implicitly taxing income and saving. And it would probably be better to come up with a tax that doesn't have that double whammy effect.
Thanks, Greg. That's Wall Street Journal chief economics commentator Greg Ipp. 20 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Thanks for spending time with us, and welcome into Monday. Beyond the headlines now, this morning's Mike Gavin is here with a look at some of the other stories you'll be talking about this morning.
Good morning. Well, where were you when you got the news that changed your life forever? No, I'm not talking about an amazing windfall or devastating family tragedy. I'm talking about the minute you saw that you've been eating pineapple your whole life completely wrong. That's what millions of people have been discovering in recent days after a video posted to Twitter went viral. In the short 13-second clip, a pineapple is shown being pulled apart piece by piece away from the core using the spiny exterior as kind of a handle. The original post has been liked and shared nearly 600,000 times, and the video has racked up over 17.6 million views.
Whoa.
As of this morning. Reactions on social media were swift and somewhat mixed, with many people crying about how their whole lives have been a lie up to this point, and some saying they immediately went to the store to try the technique for themselves. And for those who did, they seemed to have varying degrees of success. Some boasted of their success while posting their own photos to social media, while others derided the video as fake news, with some saying they were left with nothing but sore fingers and messy kitchens, and others warning that those barbs on the outside of the pineapple, quote, aren't for decoration.
Okay.
So some people kind of chimed in later and said, look, you got to wait till it's ripe. You got to wait till it's a little bit soft first. You can't just, get a super hard pineapple and try this this technique, or else you are going to, mess up your fingers big time.
I see. And how did you feel about watching?
How did I feel? I mean, I feel like I might want to try it at some point. I have not had a chance as of yet, but I'm feeling like the next time I buy a pineapple, I think I'm definitely going
to
try it.
What would seem to be the advantage here, I guess?
Well, I mean, I guess
simplicity?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, and it's sort of shareable. You kind of put it in the middle and everybody kind of picks at it, pulls little pieces off of it.
that gotcha. Kind of thing. You know, you're not going to have to slice it up. And when you slice it up, you know, you wind up throwing like half the pineapple away because, you know, it gets caught. You slice it, you know, too far in. You can never judge where exactly to slice it to get that perfect slice and not get the core, that whole thing. So, you know, it's that's just a better experience is what people are looking for.
So life is just about to begin now.
Right.
That we properly know how to cut a pineapple.
Yes. We've all been living in the dark ages up until this point.
Just past the rum.
Right. Yes, and that as well. And the Antonio Brown drama seems to finally be coming to a close. The disgruntled Pittsburgh Steelers wide receiver appears to be heading to the Oakland Raiders, though the trade can't be made official until Wednesday. According to USA Today, it doesn't look like Pittsburgh got the better of the deal, as Brown will reportedly get a pay raise to go to a team he likes, while the Steelers are agreeing to part ways with a Hall of Fame receiver for a couple of draft picks and eat over $21 million in dead money. Oh. The trade really does sound a little far-fetched when you spell it out, and if you want proof, just ask Madden. UTEP quarterback Brandon Jones did just that, posting a screenshot to Twitter of him attempting to recreate the trade in the Madden video game. And the game's response was that, quote, "The Steelers have no interest in this trade. Make a better offer."
That's funny. Very good.
Yes, I like that.
So this drama is over, it seems.
It would seem so.
Once Wednesday arrives.
It would seem so. Yeah. It's been quite an up and down year for the Raiders and their new coach, John Gruden. Some trades that people think are a little crazy, and this one seems like they got the better of the deal.
All right. We'll keep an eye on it. Thank you, Mike. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News.
There's nothing small about your business. Your passion, your hours, your reputation, it's all huge. Your partnerships, even bigger. With Dell Small Business Technology Advisors, you'll get the tech, advice, and one-on-one partnership to help your business grow. Because with reliable Dell PCs with Intel Core processors, you can focus on what matters most, getting business done. Call 877-BUY-DELL to speak with an advisor today. That's 877-BUY-DELL.
Thanks for joining us. Don't forget, we can connect on social media. You can friend us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter with the username @ThisMorningShow. You can follow me directly on Twitter as well, @GordonDeal. As you know by now, much of the country turned the clocks ahead over the weekend for daylight saving time. That can mess with our internal body clocks even more than they're already disrupted. Inverse.com says pushing the clock forward ever so slightly messes with the cycle of light and darkness that controls our circadian rhythm. That's the natural 24-hour cycle controlling our body's processes like setting its temperature and releasing hormones that, you know, make us hungry, tired, or energized. And 1 hour is a big deal. Springing forward results in more light in the afternoon and less light in the morning, disrupting the pattern that our biological clocks have become accustomed to. What we end up with is a mismatch between our biological internal clocks and the social clock that governs our lives. A 2016 study, by the way, in a publication called Sleep Medicine, reported an 8% increase in strokes the Monday after daylight saving time. And another, in a publication called Open Heart, published in 2014, noted a 10% increase in heart attacks. It's 8 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning. Jennifer Koshenka is back with more of America's First News.
Gordon, an Ethiopian Airlines jet faltered and crashed yesterday shortly after takeoff from the country's capital, spreading global grief to families in 35 countries that had loved ones among the 157 people killed. The Ethiopian Airlines Boeing 737 MAX 8 jetliner crashed en route to Nairobi, Kenya. James Macharia is Kenya's Secretary of Transport and Infrastructure.
When the flight took off from Bole International Airport, and 6 minutes later, it got lost in terms of radar surveillance.
Ethiopia and China are among the countries that have grounded all their Boeing 737 MAX 8 aircraft. China says the crash was similar enough to an October crash involving an Indonesian Lion Air jet to merit the grounding to guarantee safety. President Trump says he plans to seek $8.6 billion for additional barriers along the border as part of his budget proposal to be released today, setting up another fight over funding the president's long-promised border wall. The White House budget document will propose $2.7 trillion in cuts to non-defense discretionary spending over the next decade. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says Congress will not go along with this wall funding.
The same thing will repeat itself if he tries this again, So we hope he's learned his lesson.
Some Senate GOP aides also say they're wary of Trump's request given the recent government shutdown. A Pennsylvania man who says he was cleaning out an old videotape collection claims he found another videotape showing R. Kelly having sex with underage girls. Gloria Allred, the attorney for Gary Dennis, says it appears to show an incident separate from the 10 accounts of aggravated sexual abuse that Kelly faces in Chicago.
I would urge the public, however, to turn over these tapes, either by contacting me for a confidential conversation or by contacting law enforcement.
An attorney for Kelly says word of a new tape shows it is obviously now just open season on R. Kelly. Spring may be around the corner, but we're not out of the flu woods just yet. Activity remains high across the nation, and there's a second wave of severe infections striking some states. The CDC says there's still a steady stream of patients who are being admitted to hospitals, with 48 states and Puerto Rico reporting widespread activity.
Oh, this can't, no. We're 10 days away from spring.
I know.
We can't do this.
I know.
Thank you, Jen. 6 minutes in front of the hour. Thanks for being with us. A man who graduated from the University of Michigan 50 years ago has finally received a congratulatory telegram from family friends. The Washington Post says Robert Fink received the Western Union telegram this year. Western Union ended its telegram business in 2006. It originally arrived in 1969 at an Ann Arbor apartment Mr. Fink shared with three classmates a day after he had left to attend graduate school in New York. The Ann Arbor News says Christina Zaski rediscovered the telegram in December after removing the bottom drawer of an old filing cabinet now owned by a digital marketing agency in the city. She saw Mr. Fink's name on the paper and used the internet to find him and return the note. He's now a professor at Oakland University in Rochester, a suburb of Detroit. Mr. Fink said he's grateful that he, or regretful rather, he never had the chance to thank the family for the telegram, noting that both the husband and wife have died. It's the end of this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Morning, America's First News. Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.